and welcome to minute 68 of season 8 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Professor Sam Edwards, an associate professor of modern history at Loughborough University. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, no, it's been so much fun the last few days talking about stuff with you. You know, I've learned a lot. Hopefully your students learn as much, in each of the courses that you give that I've learned, and, you know, everyone listening has learned over the last few days.
Well, I hope so. I'm not sure, but I hope so.
If not, you can just, you know, turn this into your career. You know, start. So, minute 68 begins with Miller still trying to rationalize things and ends with Mike asking a question. So, basically, we ended things yesterday with the big conundrum. If you lose one soldier or one life, you know, is one life going to, you know, be able to save, you know, 10 times as many or however many, you know, beyond that? You know, it's, you know, the Spock adage of, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. You know, that's sort of, you know, that's something in the future, but still, you know, it makes sense today in the present, and it also makes sense, you know, in the past. With the way to do that. So the two of them are continuing with this conversation. You know, so Miller's entire line at this point is, but that means I've saved the lives of 10 times that many, doesn't it? Maybe even 20, right? 20 times as many. And that's how simple it is. That's how you rationalize making the choice between the mission and the men. And then Mike says to him, well, but this time the mission is a man. So again, it goes back to the whole idea here. What's the ultimate goal? Yeah. Is the goal, you know, throughout history, you know, whenever there have been wars, battles, someone sacrificing himself, you know, how does that affect, what goes on after that and stuff like that? I mean, you probably have a very unique perspective on it also, because you are a student of history, you know, that you've studied all these different things. And I'm sure you could bring many, many examples of different, here it's a very micro situation. You know, they're talking here about one particular man at a specific time in the middle of a battle or war. But again, if you look at history as a whole, I'm sure there are many examples of places where, someone made some sort of choice that ultimately saved tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of lives, you know, later on. So I like the way that Spielberg puts this into the context of this whole story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's almost as though this is the kind of the very heart of the whole thing, right? The heart of the whole story. It's the moral heart of it all. It's raising and addressing that question of what's the point of why? Why is this mission underway? What's its cost going to be, and what's going to come out of it? And as you say, it kind of really drills down into that. It's kind of like the moral, the ethical, the tactical, the strategic are all colliding here in this one particular thing, which is, you know, why are we trying to do this? Why are we trying to get this guy? And if we do, what does it lead to? And before that, of course, as you say, we've got that that question that he's addressing, that Miller's addressing over, you know, what he's had to do before to get to this stage, the kind of decisions he's had to make, those incredibly difficult, problematic decisions about, sending men into combat. It's the very center of the film, I think, this bit.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a well-known thing that many times, there is some sort of buffer between commanders and the soldiers on the ground for that very point, because if you know that you're going to be sending someone or X number of people into danger, it might be better if you don't know who it is, that you don't know them well enough.
Yeah.
You know, if you get too friendly with them, you might say, oh, I'm not going to send that person, or vice versa. You might say, oh, I'm going to send this person because I think that they can do it. And then if something happens to them, you know, it can get very dicey from an emotional standpoint. because commanders don't have to make the decision of who they're sending. I mean, even at the beginning of this movie, you know, when Miller is already, you know, beyond the first stage of the beach, and he has to send people, you know, across a certain area, and he's just picking people that are next to him, and, you know, he says, okay, you, go. And, I mean, they mention names at the time, so I can't remember right now the exact names. It doesn't matter. And then they don't show us, but they tell us, basically, that every one of those guys gets shot. You know, we don't know if they all were killed or anything like that, but they were at least, you know, they didn't make it through. And that's why Mike makes a statement at that point where he says it would be easier if you just give them a blindfold, basically saying that, okay, you're sending these men off to their death. But, you know, that is the you know, that's the job of a commander to make that decision as to what is the best decision at this point. You know, okay, I think that if we send five guys this way, it might help. You know, so how do you choose which of those five guys? And, you know,
it's kind of like what we've got here is Spielberg giving us a glimpse of the particular burden of the particular moral and ethical burden of combat command for the junior officer and for the non-commissioned officer, because committing men into combat in that context, it's not at the abstract level of deploying divisions or regiments or battalions. It's individuals, and I think he really does a really good job in this bit of the film with getting into that and getting into the heart of that, of the particular burden of command when you're making those kind of tactical decisions at that level, and it's not kind of, you know, anonymous entities that you're sending into potential harm, but it's people, it's individuals, and as we later learn, you know, it's people whose names he knows and remembers.
Right. Again, it's not a chessboard. You know, you know, you know, as you just said, he knows the names of the guys. Yeah. He's saying, okay, you know, Jackson, you go do this. And well, I mean, we see it in the beginning of the movie, we see it later in the movie, you know, when he needs to make these decisions and, you know, he doesn't, I mean, there's even a point a few weeks from now that we're going to get to where, you know, he chooses one guy and then he asks for a volunteer, you know, beyond that. He says, okay, Mellis, you take, I think he says the left. And you take the right. And he goes, who's going to take left?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that itself is another point where, you know, on the one hand, he's making the decision, you know, what made him decide that he wants Mellish to go and do that, but he's not willing to commit someone else.
Yeah, yeah. And what we learn as this scene develops is we're given a sense that it's this kind of burden that he's carrying, these impossible decisions he has to make, which lies at the heart of what is clearly his trauma, which we've talked about in terms of, you know, coming through in the shaking of his hand. I think this is the bit in the film where that kind of connection between that burden and that trauma is drawn out for us.
Yeah, for sure. Because again, it's you know, we see the humanity of this character. You know, a lot of times in movies, TV shows, books, even comics, okay, you see the commanders are these you know, ironclad people that don't show any emotion, and okay, you go do this, you go do this, and you know, there's no repercussions to it afterwards from an emotional perspective. But we know that Miller is definitely carrying this burden, you know. And again, he remembers everyone that he sent out, and he also knows the number. I believe he said it yesterday, didn't he? He said 93 or something like that.
That sounds right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that's again, for a commander to remember exactly how many men he has lost. You know, that also is just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that you'd think that on the one hand, you wouldn't want to remember these things, because you want to make it. It was 94. We said it 2 days ago. I recall that we had said it.
Yeah, I remember us talking. And this is what Spielberg does so well right here in this film, but so many of his others as well. This is it's the human stories at the heart of it all, and this is what makes Saving Private Ryan such a very different D-Day film compared to, you know, some of the others that we've talked about, like The Longest Day, which is, you know, panoramic and epic. And yeah, there are human stories within it, but it never quite gets to this kind of depth and detail and kind of visceral level, which Spielberg does so brilliantly with Saving Private Ryan.
The only thing, the most personal you get is to be able to see all the stars. You know.
Yeah.
There it was a star-studded event. You know, it's like, oh, there's Gregory Peck. Oh, there's this guy. There's that guy. You know, it's like all these different you know, actors that oh, there's Henry Fonda. You know, it's like just little scenes with famous actors, but they didn't go into any depth. Which, you know, I've said this. I don't know if I've said it over the last week, but I have said it in the past that the biggest flaw of The Longest Day that is only 3 hours long.
Yeah, it could have been double.
I think double wouldn't even be enough.
Yeah.
You know, with if they really went into depth onto all of that they do there. But again, it's still a very entertaining and informative movie, and that's why it's
just done in a different way and telling a slightly different story. Yeah.
Yeah. But using that as a companion piece to watching this movie is helpful also because you know they show the various stages.
Yeah.
Of D-Day, and here we see just one of those stages, and that now we know where that's placed.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, Vanda Brothers does that from the other perspective. It shows, you know, the beginning of D-Day and moves things forward, you know, so that we can see what happens afterwards also. You know, that type of thing.
As you said, they're a useful point of reference for one another. I think useful in kind of drawing out some of the contrasts and differences and how the story of D-Day might be told.
Correct. It's just great. And then Miller turns to Mike and says, well, this Ryan better be worth it. You better go home, cure some disease, or invent a longer-lasting light bulb or something. Because the truth is, I wouldn't trade 10 Ryans for one Vecchio or one Caparzo. Amen. So, I mean, this is also a very interesting comment for a commander to make. Because what Miller's basically saying here is that I don't know Ryan, and you know, Vecchio I knew, Caparzo I know that they were great and courageous men that you know that unfortunately died, but I don't know who this Ryan is, you know, and is it worth it? We don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the future might tell us that he's going to do something. You know. Very important to help save the world. The odds are that's not true.
Yeah.
The odds are that he's just going to live his, normal. I don't want to use the word mediocre, but normal life, and that'll be it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you've heard more stories than I have about you know about World War II veterans or veterans from other wars. You know where afterwards it just for them it was a struggle to get back to their regular life.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a key theme, I think, for many returning veterans after 45 is the return to normality and making lives and finding a future after everything they'd experienced and witnessed. Yeah, and this is another really interesting bit of the film as well, because also what's suggested here is that what motivates Miller is not kind of the abstract, but it's that to take that cliche, the kind of the bonds of brotherhood, right? Which bands of brothers then? Kind of explores in I guess in some more kind of in detail, and that comes out. But this is what Miller's suggesting here, right? What I care about the people I know, and those are the ones that matter to me. And the idea, and so he's kind of questioning that idea of or questioning that thought of what's motivating troops, what's getting them to endure and to kind of survive to come out the other side of it. And one of the big things that's come through in the scholarship on this and kind of combat motivation, looking at the experiences, especially of World War II vets, is that it wasn't just patriotism or love of country or a sense of solemn duty, but often it was that sense of the guy standing next to me, and that's what mattered, and that's why I did it, and that's why I endured and came through the other side of it. That kind of that sense of the bonds of brotherhood, but at that very kind of local, personal level. And I think the film does a good job in sort of tapping that and getting us thinking about that.
And again, you pointed out with Band of Brothers. I mean, that's the true story of Band of Brothers. Really epitomizes what you just said. The fact that you know, for 40 years afterwards or 50 years afterwards, they were still getting together every year.
Yeah.
Know, the fact that I mean, and obviously, I can only talk about the guys from Easy Company, but But still, it's you know, it was a known thing that they had no one else to talk to. They couldn't talk to their families about these things. So they, for them, you know, let's hide everything for most of the year, and until I go and I meet these guys that experienced this, you know, these horrors with me, that I can then maybe touch upon things. I mean, they still, you know, kept a lot of it to themselves also. You know, in my conversation with George Luce Jr., you know, the son of one of the guys from Band of Brothers, I mean, he basically told me that you know, these guys would go once a year, and they would make the effort to go meet one another for, you know, all the way through the 80s, when obviously they were starting to die out at a certain point. Unfortunately, as of today, you know, in 2025, none of them are still around. But you know, the idea was is that you know, the bonds that we formed in, you know, in Europe during that time are things that nobody else is going to be able to understand.
Yeah,
And I mean, George even mentioned to me that at a lot of their reunions, they would sometimes come across veteran other World War II veterans that were not part of Easy Company, and they would bring them into the fold, so that,
okay.
you know, people that they met maybe in a bar or something like that, and said, "Hey, why don't you come also? And you know, here's a group of people that can help you deal with what you've gone through." I guess in some ways it was a way for them to you know, treat themselves.
I think it's exactly that, a way to cope. One of the things I've written about is how that became a really big thing in the 1980s and 1990s, especially kind of on the 40th and 50th anniversaries of the conflict. By this point in time, you know, World War II veterans, they're retired, they're in their twilight, and this is an era in which many more increasingly did start to kind of want to revisit their youth and their past and get together and talk with the guys that they lived those momentous events with. And many also as well in the 80s and 90s would want to do so at least every now and again, by going back to Europe, by going back to some of their old battlefields, by being there with the guys they lived it with originally.
And I mean, from the same perspective, they would go back to, you know, to the cemeteries to go meet, to
Exactly.
just meet the men who fought with them, who, you know, some of them saved their lives, and some of them, you know, people that they had so many experiences with all those decades earlier.
Yeah, which of course this film kind of powerfully picks up on right at the start there with those scenes that Spielberg offers us of the vet walking through the cemetery. He's kind of referencing that. The film's 1998, and those activities had absolutely been a part of European summers since the mid 1980s through to the early noughties.
Exactly, for sure. And so I mean, it's a great little conversation between Miller and Mike that, you know, can spawn so much conversation about what it is that these guys are talking about and stuff like that, you know.
And the other thing that strikes me about the scene is it rewards going back to, at least in thought, when you get to the end of the film, right? That final kind of line of Miller that you and I've been using as our sign-offs, you know, earn this. This is the bit in the film which is kind of linked in to that final comment that Miller offers, because this is what he's chewing his way through here. You know, is Ryan going to be worth it?
And again, it's an interesting question, but I think that ultimately the answer doesn't matter. You know, it's not as if you know, Ryan is this special guy that everyone knows something important is going to happen to him. It's not that. They're not given this mission because of that. They're given this mission because the special thing about him is that his three brothers were killed. You know, which I don't know if you would necessarily consider that something special. You know, it's more of a, it was it's more of a way that Marshall, at least in the story, you know, wanted to help comfort their mother. That's all it is. You know, it's not, there's it's not deeper than that. It's that, okay, here's a mother who lost three sons. Let's make sure she doesn't lose four.
There's not the specialness of Ryan, it's the specialness, the tragedy of what the mother has experienced in already losing so many boys.
I mean, Ryan himself could be a complete goof-off. I mean, no one, there's no guarantee that Ryan himself is, you know, is going to do anything. I mean, again, you know, Miller mentions here that maybe he's gonna, you know, find a cure for some disease or make a longer lasting light bulb. Okay, but you know, he's saying that sort of facetiously, he's saying that let's hope that there's some added value to this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, we find out later when Miller has his speech as to, you know, why he's doing this mission, that it doesn't really matter. He's doing this mission for himself.
Yeah.
In order for him to move to the next stage and get closer to going home.
It's exactly that, isn't it? And this is what, again, is an interesting bit about this scene. It gives you a sense of what Miller at least is, where he's trying to get to. Where he's trying to get to is home, and this is the route home.
Yeah. And, I mean, we see that like, his hand is shaking along the way and stuff like that also.
We do.
You know, they subtly show that to us. You know, it's throughout the course of the movie, little by little, they're showing us and the other characters more and more the fact that his hand is starting to shake and, stuff like that.
And your choice of word there, I think, is spot on. And it's done subtly, as ever with Spielberg. It's careful. It's subtle. Yeah.
And it's something that you probably won't notice as much when you're watching this movie in the normal way, but when you're doing it in the crazy way that we're doing it, you notice it even more.
You do. Yeah, and that we, the audience, learn more about Miller, just as his squad does as well. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And then Mike says, amen. And then, you know, Miller looks at his hand, which is shaking a little bit, and goes, look, there it goes again.
Yeah.
And Mike says to him, sir, are you all right? Now, what's very interesting about that is that, you know, here they're having this conversation, and in some ways they're making it seem as if Miller and Mike are on the same level because of this conversation, but he still calls him sir.
Yeah.
You know, so he still has that built-in effect that, okay, you're still my commander, and, you know, I'm going to still deal with stuff via protocol.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you get a sense of... the closeness of the bond, of a friendship, but the boundaries of military discipline is still just there, and there we see it at the end.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way that this minute ends. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
I think we've covered it all there. It's a really interesting scene, and as I say, I think it's at the heart of the whole story, and just gives a little bit of a deeper understanding of the significance of what Miller says at the end.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so every Wednesday we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II movies. Now, I have a feeling that this probably was really difficult for you to narrow down to just five, since this is your life's work. So obviously, you can, you know, beyond the top five, you know, feel free to give us a whole bunch of honorable mentions. Maybe you'll mention things that some people out there haven't seen, and you'll be able to give them a little bit of insight into some very good movies, even if they aren't in your top five, that are worth checking out. So why don't you actually start off with your top five, and then the honorable mentions afterwards. Start with your number five and work your way up.
Okay, so as you said, this was a really tricky one. But my top five, what I've tried to do is zero in on some films which are really significant to me, which I've watched a lot, but also some films which I think are quite interesting cinematically, and the kind of the bits of the war that they choose to focus on. So number five, I'm going for A Bridge Too Far, which I think is 1977, which is in some respects a companion piece to The Longest Day, more of which in a moment's time, in terms of production team and in terms of some of what it's trying to do. It's a bit of a who's who. It's full of movie celebrities, Robert Redford, etc. And it's a really powerful story. This is about Operation Market Garden. This is September of 44. This is the Allied attempt to get to Germany quicker by seizing a bunch of bridges over the Rhine. But it doesn't quite work out. It's a strategic failure. It's the brainchild of General Bernard Law Montgomery, British general, one the guy that's in charge of land forces on 6th June 44 in Normandy. And the film works through some of those kind of tensions and complexities and some of those problems which would lead to its strategic failure. It's not perfect. There are various flaws, but it's an interesting piece of cinema. So that's my number five.
Okay. Now, from a historical perspective, when you look back at that, at the idea of Market Garden, do you think it was a good idea and just things happened and it didn't work out, or from the start it was something that didn't have much of a chance?
It's a good question. I can see the attraction, the appeal of it. I can see the strategy at work there. There's a boldness to it. And I think potentially it could have worked, but for it to have worked, the intelligence gathering needed to have been far more kind of in depth and detailed. And, you know, some of the things which emerge in the course of the campaign, that there are motivated and very capable German troops far closer to the bridge, far closer to the bridges than the Allied command thought. This is stuff that you would have hoped a kind of more comprehensive intelligence gathering operation might have kind of found out, given the stakes at play here. So I can see the strategy, I can see the attractiveness of it, but there's a bit of a question mark there, at least in terms of making sure the groundwork has been laid and the intelligence gathering is fit for purpose.
All right, that's fair. All right, what's your number four?
So number four, I just mentioned it a moment ago, I'm going to go for The Longest Day. So number four, The Longest Day. This is Daryl Zanuck. This is 1962, just like A Bridge Too Far. This is a who's who of contemporary 1960s celebrity. I think we mentioned a few names a moment ago, Robert Mitchum and Henry Fonda and Sean Connery, and the list might go on and on. It's a really powerful bit of filmmaking. It's one that I've watched a bunch of times. I think it's really interesting for when it's made there in the early 1960s. It's kind of Cold War era, and there's almost a desperate attempt at times to make sure that everyone gets a look in, you know, the American beaches, the British beaches, three French commandos landing at Ouistreham. Everyone's in there. It's not perfect, but it's a good film as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Great.
Number three, I'm going to go for, controversially perhaps, given what you and I are talking about, I'm going to go for Saving Private Ryan at number three.
That is number three. You think it's controversial that it's that higher on the list? It doesn't need to be.
Well, you know, I just thought, you know, we're talking about it in depth and detail. It's got me thinking more about it. But nonetheless, I'm going to go for Saving Private Ryan at number three for, you know, the stuff, for the reasons that you and I have been talking about over the last few days. And also because of when it came out, it's 1998, kind of, you know, my late teens formative moment. I think I spoke before about, you know, my cycling expeditions to Normandy, et cetera, which came around about this sort of time. So Saving Private Ryan's my number three.
Okay.
And my top two are both connected to the other bit of World War II that most interests me. D-Day, Normandy, absolutely is a key part of what I've researched. But the other bit is the Allied strategic bombing campaign, especially the American contribution, and especially the role of the United States 8th Army Air Force. So number two, gone from the 1949 classic, 12 O'Clock High. This is the story of a fictional American bomb group based in England. And not unlike some of what we've been talking about with Saving Private Ryan and Captain Miller, ultimately it's a story of the burden of command, of those impossible decisions that commanders in combat have to make and the cost to them. And it's well worth a watch if you haven't seen it before.
Yeah, that's Gregory Peck, right?
Gregory Peck, that one, yeah, 1949, 12 O'Clock High. Yeah, which is based on a book by the same name, which came out the year before by a couple of 8th Air Force vets. And finally, in number one, and again, we're in 8th Air Force territory, and again, a film which for me was formative because of where it came out, and that is 1990's The Memphis Belle.
I knew that's where you're going.
Yeah. So this is, again, it's not a perfect film, right? It's received various criticisms over the year, but I think it's a really well done story. It came out for me at a really important moment, early 1990s. This is when I was growing up in Eastern England, and every summer I'd see 8th Air Force veterans come back to do what you and I were just talking about, to kind of meet with each other and to talk and to revisit the past. And the film tapped some of that kind of burgeoning World War II nostalgia of the late 80s, early 1990s. So 1990, Memphis Belle, which is, of course, riffing off of a much older film, the William Wyler 1944 propaganda production, Memphis Belle, the story of a flying fortress. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is a great list. Okay, so do you have a few honorable mentions that you want to just...
There's a few. So I like some of the various films which have been made about, as I say, the Allied strategic bombing campaign and the 8th Air Force fighting out of England. So 1945, The Way to the Stars, is a nice film. It tells the story of an American bomber group arriving on an English airfield and the relationships they build with RAF comrades and also local people. Another one that I've watched a few times and gone back to a couple of times is another 1998 that you and I have talked about briefly, The Thin Red Line. It's quite sprawling. It's a little bit out there at times, but it's an interesting piece of cinematic storytelling. I'll just limit myself to one other. Again, this is World War II air campaign, and that's 1996, I think, the Tuskegee Airmen, which I think was a made-for-TV job with Lawrence Fishburne. But I think it's probably the best and filmic storytelling of the Tuskegee Airmen. For me, at least, I think it's better than 2012's Red Tails by George Lucas. And Lawrence Fishburne is great. So those are a few honorable mentions.
Okay. I'm assuming you've seen Masters of the Air.
I have seen Masters of the Air, yep, and wrote a few bits and pieces about it for various media. Yeah, I thought it was good. Again, not perfect, nothing is right, but it's a good episodic television treatment of the story of the Eighth Air Force. As a Suffolk boy from Eastern England, I would have liked to have just seen a little bit more of them there in Eastern England, because it's a key part of the World War II history of that locality. But nonetheless, it's a good TV series.
Right. I mean, I liked it a lot because it touches upon The Great Escape.
It does.
Which is another movie that I already did.
No, I had on my list here, and I thought, no, I'll leave myself to those three or four. But Great Escape, another one, yeah.
All right, excellent. So you want to tell people where they can get in touch with you?
So, yeah, so you can find me on Blue Sky now. So you can find me on Blue Sky at Sam Edwards at Running Historian.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@movearound.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.